Hey, yo, and here we go. WTC is back. It's Mo. Today I'll be recording the podcast as Sylvester Stallone. Everybody will be doing an imitation as the podcast. So, absolutely, yeah. And I got Brett. Who are you going to be this week?
I'm going to be, I'm going to be Keith.
You're going to be Keith. All right, do it. I said celebrity, but that's close.
Hi there. I'm Keith.
Keith, who are you going to be this week?
You've put me on the spot. Well, well, there, Pilgrim. Pilgrim. Ronald Reagan. That's my
Chris. Absolutely, Chris.
You dirty rat.
What's that?
You dirty rat.
Jesus Christ. Alright. Here we are once again with WTC episode, this is 14, I believe, Indie Sent Proposal. Small Press Month continues. We're moving on to Chris. Chris, so you can jump in. What would you consider to be the most important independent books in history?
Well, it goes without saying. Cerebus. Dave Sims. I mean...
Sims?
Yeah, Sims.
Sim. I could hear the apostrophe when he said that. So you watched it.
I mean, it was the first comic with a decent enough run to actually be taken seriously. Not to mention it's excellent, and invented the phone book basically.
Okay, and his press, Aardvark Press, obviously had a lot of. At least at one point, cachet within the industry. Keith, what would you consider to be the most important independent books in history? And any thoughts on the Cerebus toss out?
Cerebus was definitely on my list. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I have to put it way up there. There were independent books before it, but it was the first one where they really made it a huge deal internationally without that kind of machinery behind them of a big company.
But was that after they were discovered and commercialized into a film, or would you consider them to have done that based just on the comic book?
The comic was already a big success. I don't know what its numbers were, you know, before the cartoon came along. But the fact that they never sold off those rights, you know, became zillionaires, it started the...
Mary Julie Strain.
Did you really?
Yeah, which one of them did that?
I didn't know which one.
Kevin Eastman married Julie Strain. He's still happily married.
Really? Cool. Well, I would be too if I was married to that.
Yeah, bless him. That's why
Flack 2 Heavy Metal was made.
Oh, that's awesome.
Okay, awesome.
Well, good on him. Eastman started the museum. And, they were the first ones that didn't. They weren't creating an independent book for the purposes of creating work that they could then sell themselves to Marvel and DC. They kept making independent books, the same as Sim did. That Sim could have been an editor at Marvel. He could have gone on to do Cerebus for Epic or whatever. And there was he did a couple of page story, but he never wanted to give up the rights, never wanted to give up his control. So,
yeah. Awesome.
I put them right up.
All right, Brett, prove that you are the most important member of the podcast by throwing in what you consider to be the most important independent books of all time. And any thoughts on the other two?
Well, I mean, since I was going to go with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, then obviously I definitely agree with that that concept. I mean, it was one of the first books that I actually found as a comic book reader, and I think that also speaks to the people that it reached, because I mean I was in junior high school and I was brought into Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and I thought, wow, I mean, this is a really engaging book, and it actually got me started on independence as opposed to a lot of superhero books. So I mean, I really started reading Black and White before I actually really read that much color. I think that though for me, because you stole my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I'm actually going to go with kind of a more broader concept. I'm going to go with Will Eisner. because so many of his books were published by Kitchen Sink, and I think that they're a pretty small company in that regard. So I think that he really created that independent movement, and so many of his books, I mean, not only that, I mean, he created the trade paperback, in essence, and the graphic novel. So, I mean, what he did was just so important for comics in general that I'm going to go with Will Eisner.
Okay, I think that's cool. I'm going to go with, Dark Horse Comics Presents. Because Dark Horse essentially launched with Dark Horse Comics Presents and Boris the Bear. And while Boris the Bear did have some success, it was Dark Horse Comics Presents and the fact that this company grew out of being an independent into being considered a major publisher. And it wouldn't have done so without the success and popularity and quality of Dark Horse Comics Presents. So, and that, like I said, and Boris the Bear, obviously, I think Boris the Bear probably sales were initially higher. But the company hinged on that, on those two books, especially the Dark Horse Comics Presents. The other interesting question is, at what point in time do these things become an independent, become a mainstream? Because you could say when Wiz Comics number one launches and Captain Marvel launches, technically that's an independent book because it's an independent publisher, it's a brand new thing. But quickly, Fawcett is, and they're outselling Superman. So at one point in time, does that change? Same thing with, you could look at an Image. You could say when Image is first created, was it immediately a major publisher, or was it how long before you considered it that? Was it when the first issue of Wildcats is solicited, are they already a major publisher, or could you say that's still an independent book on issue one, and therefore one of the most important as well? So, Keith, you look like you have some thoughts on those. I may be well, reading too much into your face, because I did say the words Keith having thoughts.
Wildstorm is an interesting example because, you know, we were talking in the last episode about whether it's the size of the company or whether it's creative control that really determines this, you know, small press independent. And Wildstorm maintained the rights to all of their stuff. Yes, Jim Lee created most of the characters, but everyone else that played in that universe didn't own the stories that they were working on. And a lot of the other creators from Image did that. And while while Eric Larson still owns Savage Dragon, anyone else who worked on a Savage Dragon comic doesn't own anything that they worked on. They're work for hire same as anyone else.
Yeah. It was interesting how quickly they became, their mentality changed when the money was on the line to being very similar to those that they had once kind of, what would you say? Once they had issues with, you know, Marvel and these things and creative control and that type of thing. Once they became, they quickly in their mindset changed to becoming similar to Marvel and DC. Keith, you have a thought there as well, I could tell.
It happened very, very early on Spawn. One of the first legal problems that Image had was the dispute between Neil Gaiman and Todd McFarlane over Evangeline.
Mm-hmm.
That they co-created that character. It was part of an arc of stories where Frank Miller, Dave Sim, Neil Gaiman, and who's the fourth creator? It's four issues. That they all wrote issues of Spawn, and then
Who was it you said? Dave Sim,
Frank Miller,
Neil Gaiman. Why the hell can't I remember the fourth one either? It's pissing me off.
Was it Neil Adams?
No,
he was supposed to have a crossover. It never happened.
I can't remember what the fourth one was. Yeah, someone will tell us that.
Yeah, somebody will tell us.
But later, McFarlane wanted to keep using the character, and then they had a dispute about who actually owned that character. Which, you know, according to the dream of Image, shouldn't have happened. That shouldn't have been a discussion.
Well, it sounds like we could very easily get off into a history and legacy of Image, and that would be a fascinating show down the road. But today we're going to continue with the independent books. Any last thoughts there from you, Chris? Or can you move on to, if not, feel free to move on to your all-time personal favorite, independent books?
I just wanted to, I think the independent comics actually probably started with the launch of the comics from San Francisco, Robert Crumb.
Yeah, but those were strips,
with the
really.
Comics.
Those were strips. That's why I didn't include that myself. Those are more strips than personally. That's the way I viewed them. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that's personally how I viewed them. That's why I didn't include them.
No, the comics with an X, I thought, really created the independent, what we know now as an independent comic. Yeah, you could be right. I never really thought about it that way.
No, but, I think you're right, Chris. Let it go. You can stay. You can stay right.
He's right.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right. I don't think that without Robert Crumb you don't get hate, that's going to be on my list of favorites.
That's probably true. You probably have a good point there. But Fritz the Cat though was a strip though, wasn't a comic book, and that's probably the one that he's best known for his work, right? So I mean that's kind of why I say that. But I mean again, I think we're talking semantics here. That's not really worth it. Chris, move on. Your favorite.
Okay, my favorite. I'm going to take a little bit of a runner. A comic book I know not a lot of people have ever read. Lethargic Lad.
Nice.
Written by Greg Hyland. Had a large run in the 80s. I remember picking up several issues and laughing. A character that doesn't do much. He doesn't even really talk.
You see, it's almost like he doesn't have much energy. Like he's, I don't know.
He doesn't do anything.
Lethargic.
That's his superpower.
You know what? Lethargic. I may have that same superpower.
Almost for sure. But in researching Lethargic Lad, and I'm so happy to see this, Lethargic Lad still exists to this day as a weekly webcomic. And it's collected in a trade paperback as soon as they got enough webcomics. So do check out lethargiclad.com.
Beautiful.
You'll find some good stuff.
Okay, do you want to throw out another one, or do you want us to come back to you, or?
I think we should go around.
Let's go around in case people start rude. Yeah, up. Exactly. You might throw out every one that I have. Keith, what's on your list?
I'm going to go with Puma Blues, or Puma Blues, whichever way you want to pronounce it. This came out of the Aardvark Vanaheim, which you mentioned earlier, when Dave Sim was going to be a publisher. Didn't last very long. Sim had problems with distributors very early, became political, and he just got out of distributing.
Dave Sim, political?
But this was Michael Zulli's first work, and Black and White, really great book. Unfinished, unfortunately.
Okay, Brett, throw out one.
Well, there's so many to choose from, but I'm gonna go a little more on the beaten path, and I'm gonna go with Strangers in Paradise.
Mm-hmm. I was waiting for one of you guys to do it.
Oh, of course. You know, it's one of my favorite books of all time, and Terry Moore is just one of my favorite creators, and I think that, you know, it's a series that it of course went to into Wildstorm for a little bit, and it tried to hit the mainstream, but he was never as happy in the mainstream as he was on his own. So, you know, he's definitely better off on his own.
Okay, excellent. We've already talked about Doug Slack and Slacker, so I'm not going to throw that one out there, really, though I kind of just did. But, you know, I'm not going to go too deep into it other than say I loved it. It was awesome.
Very tempting, though.
Yeah, but since Brett just talked about how Strangers went to Image, I'm going to throw out another one that did the same thing. And that would be Bone. I mean, how can you not throw Bone in there, right? I'm sure everybody had it on their list. It's such an incredible read. And was published at Cartoon Books, was published for a little while, Image. They did the same thing, try and get extra distribution out there, but quickly reverted back to Cartoon Books. Didn't need it, and he's done very, very well. Groundbreaking book in many ways in that I think... It reestablished in an era where grim and gritty had become so popular, the idea that you could be adult but still be lighthearted and all ages to many comic book fans. So I think that's kind of the legacy of Bone personally. Chris, brought another one.
Well, you sort of took mine with Bone, but I am going to go with another oddity.
Of course you are.
Wabbit Wampage. Yes, it is exactly as crazy as it sounds. Just think Watership Down with chainsaws.
Beautiful. I got nothing to add to that.
I still own that book to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I still own that book to this day.
beautiful. All right, Keith, did you read that one?
I don't think I have read that, no.
Well, there you go. Four away.
I'll put that on my bin diving list.
It'll take you 5 minutes.
I remember Brett lending it to me, and yeah, it took me maybe 5 minutes. I was going to read it at home, but I read it before I got out the front door. It was great, though.
You flipped through and accidentally read the whole
thing. Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. All right, Keith, throw out another.
I'm going to go with a line of books. Now, this line is, it's hit and miss. There are four or five unfinished miniseries from this character. They have restarted this character over and over. The Tick.
Oh, on my list, too.
New England Comics.
On my list, too.
And the whole, all the spinoffs, too. Paul the Samurai, Chainsaw Vigilante, The Man-Eating Cow. That's a great book. The Man-Eating Cow is one of my all-time favorite indies because it is exactly what it says on the cover. It's just about a man-eating cow. And to have your lead character never say a word and not actually be a fully sentient character is awesome. Those two only, that and Paul only ran 10 issues each, but just fun. And I think there's probably five unfinished miniseries from the...
Awesome. And in many ways, you could say an unfinished live-action TV show.
That's right.
That was also awesome.
And an unfinished cartoon.
Yeah, exactly. Brett, go ahead.
Let's see now. I think next up, I'm going to go with Channel Zero. This is the book that really started me loving Brian Wood. And it's one of those things that actually I discovered because... the introduction is written by Warren Ellis. And I thought to myself, if Warren Ellis likes this book, then damn it, I have to read it. And I just thought it was so cool and inventive. And Brian Wood has just been one of those guys that, I mean, really it doesn't matter if he's working on DC books or anything, but his self-published stuff is amazing.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. I'm going to throw out another one. Howard the Duck fans. Destroyer Duck. Enough said. Chris?
I hated that, actually.
Well, maybe you're too much of a Howard the Duck fan. I just appreciate that it was somebody giving, in the early days, somebody who was able to get a little bit of sales going while giving a middle finger to a major publisher. So anyway, and many people like John Byrne.
Okay, continuing my theme from Wabbit Wampage, I'm going to go with Scud the Disposable Assassin. Once again, lots of blood, not a lot of story, but just a good read.
Absolutely hilarious. Wasn't there a video game that came out like for a Super Nintendo for that?
Yes, an excellent one, actually. Yeah. And there's been talk of a movie, but nothing ever happened to it with it.
Yeah, it would be a great 3D... computer animated film. Keith, go ahead.
Normal Man.
Nice.
Jim Valentino. It's I'd have the fantastic phone book collection of that series because I was never able to put together a whole collection of the single issues, which is a problem on some of these indie books. You can bin dive for years and never come up with a full set of something like Normal Man. So that he finally finished it, and every little story from the side stories and the appearances all are in one big
book. Is Normal Man for the uninitiated?
He is a unpowered kind of nebbish character who Superman is sent in a rocket ship from a destroyed world and lands on a planet of only superheroes. So he is the only person that does not have superpowers on the planet.
Nice.
And then each issue was a bit of a parody of a genre or a particular book. So there's a Cerebus issue. There was an American Flag issue. He did a lot of nods toward other creator-owned books.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, Cerebus, since it started off as a, you know, Conan the Barbarian and Krull kind of parody that other people ended up parodying him down the road. Brett, go ahead.
Another tough one, but I'm gonna throw it a guy that's been through so many companies that it's not even funny. I'm gonna go with Flaming Carrot.
I knew you'd have him.
I know. He's just he's just one of the most inventively crazy characters that goes and does completely random things in any issue. It doesn't matter. He can cross over with any character. Doesn't matter. But at the end of the day, he's going to say something weird, and it's going to be funny, and I'm going to like
another
it.
Another one that Dave Sim was, Artwork of Anaheim, was publishing for a while, weren't they?
Well, I think yes. It might have been three.
Yeah.
It was a very brief.
Very brief.
It was like three issues or something like that. I mean, like I say, that thing has been through, like Burton has brought that thing through so many companies, it's not even funny.
Okay.
I think there's more crossovers than Flaming Carrot issues.
Probably.
You might be right on that. But,
beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. I'm going to throw out one that probably, again, people are more familiar with, but in case you're not, go read this. And then watch the movie, and then read this again. That's American Splendor. Brilliant. Chris.
Okay, I'm going to go one with actually published by Dark Horse, but I think it would qualify. Chud, Terry Laban, in doing a fabulous Freak Brothers type comic book. Very funny, very hip, very drug friendly. funny stuff, though.
If you could have seen the look on Brett's face as you said that, you know why I'm laughing so hard.
I've read it.
Keith, and then I'll let Brett comment on his and Chris's.
The Max. Sam Keith.
It was Image, though.
Sam
does it count?
Total creator control. He never had anyone else write or draw any of the issues, and then carried the character out to other publishers for a few appearances.
Master Lobes did one issue.
Oh, he might. Yeah, I guess he did have a scripter or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So he drew and plotted, but yeah, I think you're right that he had a scripter for a while.
Cool.
But screw
it. Great comic book.
Scripters.
Come on.
They don't deserve royalties anyway. So.
Don't ruin a good podcast with facts there, Chris. That's not your job. That's never been your job. Why start now? Brett, you have some things to say, I think.
I think as long as the comic book has moved around potentially, you know, and the creator has felt the need to go from one company to the next, then I definitely think that it will fit on this list. For me, I'm going to go with another book by one of my favorite creators of all time. It's kind of a short story collection where he felt free to do, like he would actually adapt songs, he would adapt poems, he would tell original stories. It's by Charles Vess, and it's The Book of Ballads and Sagas.
Oh, nice. That's one I've never read, but I'd love to.
It's so beautifully drawn, and because Charles Vess is such a fantastic artist, and it's one of those things that got me into a couple of folk acts that I found really engaging. But it's a really interesting book. It can be hit and miss, but when it hits, it's really good.
Awesome, man. I love that. That's a great choice. I'm going to throw out one. We're talking about moving around from publishers then. I'm going to talk about one that started with Pacific, ended up with Marvel under the Epic imprint. Was Dark Horse for a little while, I believe. I know it was Image. I'm sure it's a goddamn, I love this book. One of maybe my favorite ever for independent books. Brett, you know what I'm talking about. It would be?
Oh, yeah. Gru.
Gru the Wanderer. I could not love Gru more. I love all his stuff. I love the Gru card game I got that nobody got, like 12 people on the planet got. And it was awesome. We played it little card dice game, and I still have that in case you guys want to go to a bar and give it a shot sometime. I'm a huge fan of Gru. I think Gru is funny as hell. I think Gru is a great book to give your kids and great for adults, and just an all-time favorite. How can you not love Sergio? Chris, you got any more there?
Yeah, I can always come up with something. how about Cry for Dawn? No story whatsoever. Just beautiful painted artwork.
Yeah.
I was actually going to jump on that one coming right up. So.
What a bastard.
You thiefed me.
Hey, you stole three from me. So.
Keith, go ahead.
For those keeping score at home. John Sable.
Oh, nice.
Girl.
I was really, waiting for a Grell book to come up from you.
Really, anything. I mean, first comics kind of set the stage for so much creator-owned under one umbrella. And, you know, a lot of great books, but John Sable and American Flag really stand out and still hold up. I'm slowly collecting up the IDW reprints of Sable books. They're beautiful books. Reprinting and recolored Grell's entire run.
Brett, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's very tempting. There's a lot of there's a lot of people, you know, and there's you know, I could easily grab something from Keith's list, but I'm actually going to go with Mouse Guard.
Oh, yeah.
This is a book that I actually discovered when I was in at Comic-Con one year, and I was talking to the creator, and I just wound up grabbing one of the hardcovers of the book, and you know, I took it home and I read it, and I thought, this is a really, really good book. Like, it's just really nicely drawn. It's got a really engaging story, and I've read two of the arcs, and it's just a really nice story with a good backstory, and all about mice. You know, so what could be better than that? But no, it's a great book.
No, you know what? That is a great book. I know you recommended it to me, and I gave it a try, and it was awesome. I'm going to actually throw this out because you say, what could be better than that? And it's about mice. How can we forget this, both in when we were listing best, not only personal favorites, but most important? And as the only comic book I could think of, Kevin, when the Pulitzer Prize for, yeah, and Keith is shooting himself in the head for having forgotten it as well. Pulitzer Prize for literature. Yeah. Just so, the most brilliant comic book maybe ever. Certainly an argument could be made. And that is Art Spiegelman's Mouse. For you unfamiliar, it is both the story of his father's surviving during the World War II as a Jew, as well as his relationship with his father in adulthood and how difficult that is. And nothing's more poignant, nothing's better, nothing is better, honest to God. So it should have been on both lists. Chris, clean up anything else you might have.
Okay.
We can go out all night with this.
I want to say you bastard for leaving me on such a note, but I'm going to go with Jim Rat, Grim Jack, also by first. Well, no, you just sort of left comparing.
No,
Jim,
seriously. I know. It's not exactly
Grim Jack to Mouse.
Seriously, it's a good one. I love it. Isn't it awesome?
It's a solid book. I kind of like how it crosses all genres.
Dude, who's the creator? It's killing me because I should know it.
John Ostrander.
Thank you, it's Ostrander, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it's awesome stuff. Keith, go ahead.
That is a tough transition to go from. That's like, have you seen Saving Private Ryan? and also,
Toy Story.
Have you seen Die Hard 4?
Yeah, exactly. you know what was good? That afternoon I watched Mad Max and Schindler's List. Really, really good stuff. They went well together.
That's like a fine wine and Gatorade right there.
No kidding. Well, that is good, though.
go ahead. I'm going to go with Rocketeer.
Oh, yeah.
Not a lot of stories, and if anyone holds the record for most publishers per issue, then it's got to be Rocketeer, because I think it took him 5 publishers to get out 6 issues. They are all collected now. You can get them all in one handy book, as opposed to Brett and I would bin dive for different individual short stories that were at the back of first comics.
And how underrated is that movie? I would love to review that one sometime, guys. I think it's a very underrated film.
We should cue that up, because, yeah, I know that there's just been a restoration for the anniversary on Blu-ray and DVD, so yeah, that's give me a good excuse to pop down to the store and buy that.
Yeah, Timothy Dalton in his best role, because you've got to hate him.
And then I could write off the purchase against my salary, right?
How easily, yeah.
Tax deductible research.
Brett, clean up anything else you have left there, Keith? You mentioned hate. Let's clean it up, because we'll go on another night.
Hate for sure. I'd like to see some more. He's done a couple of annuals the past few years. I think it's been about 2 years since he did one of those, though, Peter Bagg. And they haven't collected up those loose pieces yet, but there are two collections of all 30 issues of the originals, and really nice collections. Buddy Goes to Seattle, Buddy Goes to Jersey.
Yep.
Buddy Goes to Jersey. So yeah, 15 issues each. They're very affordable, $20 or something for 15 issues. Great.
Oh, they're beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. And the Bradleys too.
Oh yes, in the Bradleys collection. Yeah, there's enough.
Not as nice, but
yeah, there's enough after the regular series of paint though to do another collection. I'm hoping that they do that.
Awesome, Brett. Clean up anything else, or unless you have anything else there, Keith.
Sin City would be the last one I'd throw out there.
Oh yeah. See, it becomes difficult because it's like, is Sin City an independent? You're right, it probably is under what we're saying. I mean. If we're throwing out Sin City, you know how many more I could throw out that are on that kind of sort of independent, sort of not?
It's tough, and Brett and I were just venting before the show about Frank Miller and exactly what day he started to suck. So it is. I'm going to say that day must come after Sin City. But
yeah, it would probably be March 16th. I think it was not March 16th at 3:42 p.m.
Maybe when the last panel of Martha Washington was drawn, that may be it.
Could be. Brett,
figure that out.
Brett, go ahead. Yeah. Anything else?
Well, I want to finish my rodent enjoyment, and I'm going to go with Adolescent Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters. I know it was basically just a ripoff in the Funny Animals, but the Clint the Hamster Triumphant storyline, which just took so many references from so many great movies like Apocalypse Now, is just fantastic and well worth it. I'm going to go with Dreadstar.
Oh, yeah.
It's another, you know, Starlin is a great creator, and it is, I mean, it's not there all the time, but when it is there, it's a really good book. And I'm also going to go with one of my favorite creators who created mostly for independence, Tim Truman.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many books like Dragon Chang and stuff like that I just found really, really excellent that I think he's worth a mention in this case.
Awesome. I mean, since you mentioned that, I'm just going to throw out a couple. Just if we're throwing out Sin City, I'm going to throw out Whiteout, because I think that was awesome. I'm going to throw out Breed, because Brett mentioned Starlin, and I loved Breed. That was Malibu and their first imprint, was it? Is that the name of the imprint?
Legend. Bravura, yeah.
Pardon me?
It was Bravura.
Bravura, thank you very much.
Legend was the Dark Horse.
Legend was the Dark Horse equivalent, okay. But yeah, I loved Breed. That was terrific. Concrete. Man, Concrete was awesome. I don't know when the last time a Concrete has come out, but I can't recommend Concrete. If you want maybe a book you don't know, if you're unfamiliar with it, you probably don't know what to expect. Really just expect the best character-driven storyline you could ever get about a guy who has essentially gone through what Ben Grimm went through, but is no superhero, you know, has been turned into a rock creature, basically is what I'm saying.
So how do you count Concrete, but I couldn't count Sin City?
Oh.
Concrete wasn't always. I don't think Concrete was always published by Dark Horse, was it?
I believe it was.
Was it? Yeah. Well, either way, I came up with it after you said it, so that's why.
After I changed.
Same with White House.
Inspired by.
All right, that's. Let's move on because there will always be Small Press Month next year.
I just have to add something here.
Of course, you do your best.
Brett mentioned Dreadstar. Do not read the Peter David stuff.
You can read the Peter
Only
David.
The Star
no,
one.
You can read the Peter David stuff for Bravura. That was actually okay. But you're right. When he took over, otherwise that was a crappy crap the bed. Unfortunately, Keith, what are you thinking over there? You're just laughing like a little bastard.
The word picture of Peter David crapping the bed.
A brand his size doing it. You're right, it would be
whole
quite...
brain dysfunctional. Just him grabbing the bed and writing at the same time.
But I digress.
Oh, we're classing this podcast up, aren't we? So, you know what, let's class it up a little bit. Let's actually, we're going to just quickly, since we're talking Small Press and we're talking all this stuff, let's quickly just drop to a quick interview we did with Mike from Phoenix North. Kind enough, he looks 13, but he's actually like 38, and he does a great job actually giving us kind of, we thought it might be interesting for some of the issues that we talked about to kind of have a perspective of a retailer, because really we're just idiots who, it's been a long time since we've been retailers, and we're idiots. So we're going to drop to that, and when we come back, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about three more independent books that we've been kind enough to get digital previews for. So we'll drop to that and talk to you again in just a moment when Brett starts to talk about going through whichever of the books he wants to talk about first.
Mo and Keith here once again with Free Talk Comics, looking for an interview with a retailer. Please introduce yourself and plug anything you'd like to.
Michael Bauer from Phoenix Comics North, and we're going to have all the DC number ones back in stock over the next 2 weeks.
That's right, DC Comics North, Calgary.
Calgary, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. But one of the things I want to talk about here is 52 has brought in increased sales for everybody. Have you seen, though, as a single issue sales have gone up, have you seen the sales of things like trade paperbacks, that type of thing, a correlation, or have they gone down? Or
They haven't gone down. It seems like a lot of the people who are maybe usually a trade paperback kind of market, actually giving the number ones at least a chance. Number twos are just starting to come out, so we haven't seen whether these people continue or they sampling the number ones to find out which trades they want to buy.
One of the things that I'm kind of curious about is we see the sales increase for something like this. How much pressure do you feel when marketing yourself? How much of the pressure do you think is on the comic book companies to try to get people through the door, and how much do you think is on you?
It's pretty even. I mean, we both benefit from it, so I mean, I think it's both parties' responsibility.
What about when the digital books are starting to come around? I know the Avenging Spider-Man is going to have a same-day digital issue, and I think the sales will be strong in stores for it, but there seems to be some pushback from retailers regarding that. How do you feel?
So far, we haven't seen much impact from digital at all. I mean, it is a concern, but so far, it hasn't been a negative. So far.
It hasn't been a negative so far. So if you're looking at it as a concern, though, how do you think to yourself, I'm going to market what we have as a different experience? Are you already starting to think that, or is it something you haven't worried about yet? Or
probably, yeah, for the most part, haven't really worried about it from a marketing standpoint yet. I mean, we, over the last many years, have diversified as a store our product content in case digital just wipes out print medium altogether. But
is that a fear of yours, or?
Yeah. I think if you're selling paper product in this digital world, you should be a concern of yours. Yeah.
Have you tried?
I don't think it's immediate, but 10, 20 years from now, it could definitely happen.
How many years actually have you been at this now?
Since 94.
Since 94, so 17 years. Am I right?
Yep.
High five. Excellent. Well, I'm also just kind of wondering then. Have you tried digital comics yourself?
Yeah, I bought an iPad the first week to check it out, and
yeah.
It just didn't appeal to me. You know, I might be biased, but it just wasn't the same. I didn't really like it. I tried out all the different readers, or all the different like Comixology's one and DC or Marvel's one, and I've since tried out the newer one, whatever its name is. I didn't find any of them great. I'd rather have a real book in my hands.
What about thinking to yourself, is there a way that we can market digital in our store and still have sales? Has that kind of come through your head yet?
I don't see that happening. No. Like people who, like the point of digital is you buy it at home in your bathrobe. You're not going to a store. Like, I don't see that as viable, personally.
You know, that in-store experience, it's not just the book for me. It's that in-store experience of being hanging out with people who you don't really know, and yet it feels like you know them immediately. You're able to talk about a topic like your old friends because you have this in common. And that to me is,
you do that digitally too.
I think that's also a fear there.
That's chat rooms and that sort of thing. You can do all that digitally just as easily, I think. So, yeah, I mean, I could be wrong, but I just don't see that. The market who wants the digital thing, I don't know if they want that experience necessarily or in that form.
Okay, how about
first announced it there was, but I don't think we had maybe one file drop their DC titles over this. And compared to the, you know, hundreds of new people who are buying it, it's not a significant number.
Okay. Excellent. Well, I really appreciate your time.
All right, thanks. Thank you.
I'm going to thank Mike for the nice interview. Again, that's Phoenix North in Calgary. All right. So I'm going to move on now to our lovely independent comic books that people have been so generous to allow us to read. And I'm going to start with Monstrosis. Now, Monstrosis is a book that I wasn't really sure about when I first picked it up, because again, it's really bulky. There's so many words in this book that I think that Jeff Johns really is like the complete antithesis. But
George Perez thought this was too wordy.
yeah, that's right. But the fact is Monstrosis is a book where they're kind of playing it as they have a whole bunch of random monster stories, and they've kind of thrown it onto the floor, and it's like they've picked up all the pages and put it together at random. So there's things that don't make sense, and there's references that they don't even try to go anywhere with, and it's really, they're trying to be a throwback to those old monster comics, but, you know, I'll tell you, I got 5 pages in, and I was laughing my ass off. Like, I thought that this was one of the funniest books, despite the fact that I'm not actually that big a fan of monster comics. I thought this book was really funny. The art matched those books completely. The lame things that they say matched that type of book completely. You know, I thought this was a winner.
Keith, your thoughts?
It was a fun book. It was a bit of a slog because it is so text heavy. It is so very, very self-aware of what it's trying to do. And the editorial notes of, you know, go see number 282 published in 1954, very much playing up that, you know, we've published 1,001 issues of this comic before. The art is very Kirby, Kirby did start with Marvel doing monster books, which is actually where the thing comes
from. Actually, it wasn't even Marvel then, but it was before it was Marvel. What were they called again?
The Timely.
Timely, yes, thank you.
Timely, yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. I don't know how many I would read before that would get a bit thin for me. This was a free download from Slave Labor Graphics, so we've been loving those first issue free previews that they put on their website. Good fun. Don't think too hard while you're doing it.
I think that if
what if you know me to think too hard? Think.
Yeah, well, that's not going to be a problem. But if they released 4 per year, I think that would be an ideal schedule for this book.
Yeah, well, it'd take that long to write it.
Well, yeah.
Chris, your thoughts?
Everyone, I'm sure, is expecting me to love this book because I love Kirby. But I really didn't even get it. I found the, let's call it, editorial narration annoying after about 5 pages. Love the art. I love the sentiment. I love the tribute. But I wouldn't pick up a second issue.
I did expect you to like it. I owe Brett a dollar.
You heavy better. How many pages was this book? Anybody have an idea?
22, I think.
That's it?
I think it was 29, actually.
Yeah, well, it shows up as 29, but actually it's probably about 24 of story. Maybe 22. 22 to 24 of story.
Okay.
Because there's pinups.
And the pinups are awesome. All the art's awesome. I absolutely love the art. I really did. It was so perfect for whatever. You would have thought, if you told somebody this is Kirby, somebody who is an expert artist, they'd believe it was. I'm sure. A long-term industry veteran. But I'm sure that person would think, as I pull a Chris, I'm sure that person would think that actually was Kirby. If you ask somebody who had studied Kirby and was influenced by him, it's that perfect. It's kind of like the Naked Gun or Airplane of comic books to some degree, in that there's just so many jokes coming at you so fast. And it's a lot of text to read, so you have to read the text sometimes a couple times because you know there was a joke or two or three in there. But unfortunately, towards the end, much like I can't necessarily watch those films as much as I love them all the time, I don't think I could read this all the time either. There was by the end, you're like, okay, that editorial joke with the editor jumping in and saying something and look back that you were doing on panels on the first, you know, two, three, four pages. The fact that you're still doing it on the 24th page or whatever, and it's the same joke and you haven't come up with another one, I think that does hurt it. I think that it started to get it just a little bit, it wore on me a little bit, which is too bad. I say the first 6 to 8 pages, I'm just loving it. And by the last page, I'm like, okay, I need to step away from this book. But
I think if you read 5 pages a day, then maybe that's the best way to go.
Yeah, really. Well, I mean, and since it does break up into a bunch of little stories, you'll go ahead and do that anyways. You know, like Brett said, it's like a bunch of stories almost thrown together in a mishmash of makes no sense and in order. So maybe read that little mini 3-page arc that is apparently from issue 826 or whatever. So let's move on to the next book. Keith, lead horse, please. Go ahead. And when I say not horse's ass, though, I could have.
The Hero Code. We got a hold of this because Jonathan Rector, who did the art on this book, also did the standard that we reviewed in our last podcast. This is a very introductory book, setting up what appears to be a team book. I do really enjoy the art. It's rough, it's early. He's got some growing to do, but reminded me a lot of Humberto Ramos, particularly his earlier, you know, Deviate and that kind of era. But still a bit of today's work that he's been doing on Spider-Man he's doing now. It's a fun little book. I can't say too much about what happened in the book because it felt very, very set up. But I'd be curious to read more. It was an interesting little tale.
Chris, your thoughts on Hero Code?
I have this marked down to check back in around issue 7 when they've actually developed some storyline and introduced a villain or two. Once again, this book was just an introduction. We met the three main characters briefly for maybe 2 or 3 pages each. I love the art. The facial expressions especially I thought were great. But really, I really got the feeling of a generic superhero universe and wasn't really felt any need to like jump right on this book.
Yeah, I really like the book. I think the pacing is really good. The dialogue is really good. For me, it's introducing a superhero team. I love the art, like I say. It did a better job for me if I was completely unfamiliar with the characters in Justice League of introducing the characters than this did, as far as I'm concerned. If that's the comparison, is setting up to somebody who's never read a comic book or never read this issue, a team book and developing it, I think this is better. Maybe there's a few too many characters thrown in there, so it becomes a little bit difficult. But I think it did a better job than Justice League if that's the comparison. And I think that says something. I think it has a lot of potential. I think it's going to be a fun book. It's going to be kind of a retro fun, good superhero book. I do wonder, though, I mean, I think if you have a name like Hero Code, at some point in time you should tell us what the hell that is. That's my only real gripe with it. Other than that, I really liked it, and I'd like to, I'm looking forward to reading some more. Brett.
I would totally compare it to the new Jeff Johns issue of Justice League because it has that same feeling like, oh, look, we're going to introduce this character, and we're going to introduce this character. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I agree. Like, there's a few extra characters that I'm, like, and some of the pages I thought with, like, the policeman and that kind of thing I thought might have stretched on a little too long. But otherwise, I mean, the art is really good. And I think it's only going to get better.
Well, I mean, some of his characters in this book are Superman. Are so heavily there's a character so heavily based on Wonder Woman. A character so heavily based on Batman. I mean, there's no denying that it's like he's playing with these characters without having these characters to a large degree, which is fine.
Oh yeah, I don't have a problem with it whatsoever. I mean, if you can do it better. But
how can you not?
Yeah. But, you know, like, I like the art, and I think that this is a book that again, you know, it might take a few issues, but I think that I'm in for that haul.
You seem like something's spinning around in your head there compared to what we said there and comparing it to Justice League there, Keith, or are you just smiling because you wish you had thought of that? You wish you had thought of what I thought of. Is that it?
Not a day goes by, Mom.
I know.
No, it was interesting, and you know, we had that with Red 10 of, you're consciously creating analogs to existing heroes, and I think that's fine as a starting point as long as you start from there and then move on with how they're a unique character.
Yeah.
In the same way that, Punisher is a ripoff of Mac Bolan, but after a couple of years, they weren't the same character.
Yeah, I know, because Mac Bolan's good.
That's right.
Chris, you have our final review.
Yes, final review. Epic. This comic book, I have difficulty describing the story because we've all read it before. You've got a teenage superhero, you got a crazy stupid battle scene. You've got a nonsense origin story in there. And I loved it. It completely like superhero 101, and you can tell the writer Tyler James loves comic books, and he just puts fun stuff into an issue. There's no standout moments, I don't think, in this comic book. It is just this is why we fall in love with comic books in the beginning with. You can tell the writer loves it. You can tell the artist loves it. And it's not particularly innovative, but they got me on issue 2. I really want to get it. I can't wait.
Yeah, you know, Tyler seems like a really good guy and really a cool guy and a talented writer. Also with Red 10 there. I hope someday maybe he'll give us a few minutes of his time. That'd be awesome. I also really like this book. Like you say, I mean, if you loved Spider-Man at some point but don't love what they do now, perhaps maybe you do if you're reading Spider-Island, but just kind of how the character's moved away from being that teenage, relatable character, this is that character now. He's a very relatable. He's got his family I really related to. I just think it was really, again, really well-paced, really good dialogue, nice book, fun book. I have one issue with the book. As much as I really, really like this fun superhero throwback with a modern twist and really good stuff, and that is this. This is a character who they say he has all these superpowers. He's epic, except for when he's around a beautiful woman, then he's literally powerless. But it doesn't happen at all in issue 1. So if that's the hook for the character, if that's the unique take, what? I think that's a miss. Brett, your thoughts on Epic?
Yeah, you know, I was actually expecting that to happen in issue 1.
Well,
and
only
then
because,
I
yeah,
was
why
a little
wouldn't
surprised
you?
When it didn't. Yeah. No, you know, this character is obviously a Spider-Man take, and I really enjoyed the book. I do look forward to issue 2. I think the interesting thing that I'm noting is that when we are looking at superhero books right now, we are looking at these independent creators and we're going, you know, these guys are writing great superhero books. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at the people who supposedly do superhero books better than everyone else, and almost to the point where independent books for the longest time got pushed out of the superhero genre. And now we're looking at like DC and Marvel and we're saying like, you know, okay, you guys write superhero books, but they're nowhere near as good as these independent creators right now.
Now, you know, it's funny, Brett, because when we talked about our favorite independent books, I don't think a superhero book was among them unless you count, you know, Radioactive Hamsters. Like, it was, you know, it wasn't that, but you're right. These are superhero books and we're seeing a lot of superhero books and it's like, they don't have all the pressure and all the editorial mandates and all this bullshit that creators are forced into in the major publishers. And, you know, it seems it's almost very freeing. And I think that might be the maybe that's why we're seeing what we're seeing in the quality. But there's obviously a lot of talent out there, talent ready to write at one of the major publishers right now. Brett, what else?
Well, I think it also is lending credence to a little bit to what DC has done, and the concept that you can actually kind of shut down, or that you should be able to shut down an entire universe and reboot everything. Because I think that we're seeing these characters as, like, they have a backstory, but we don't know it. So we don't actually need that history right now to enjoy that book. And I think that maybe if DC and Marvel took that to heart a little bit more and actually said, like, okay, these characters have a history, but we're gonna reboot them fresh.
Yeah, instead of just alluding to things that we think may have happened and then telling us later it didn't. Keith, please, your thoughts on Epic.
I did enjoy it. I also wondered about the Pretty Girl Kryptonite thing. The only reference, I think, in the book is that he's fighting one of the female villains, and his powers do work, and he says, you just don't do it for me anymore. Which is a bit of a curious, that the power is completely, it's not based on whether they're objectively pretty, it's whether he is actually attracted to them, which is a strange, bit of a, perhaps a psychosomatic problem with his powers as opposed to a functional.
But, you know, I've had the same thing with my powers, if you know what I'm saying. All right, go ahead. Keith, continue. I'm sorry.
Just couldn't get off the ground there.
pretty much.
Epic did have that. Yeah, I'd agree with the Spider-Man comparisons, but I think any teen character, you throw in Static or... the new Blue Beetle, any teen character like that, you've got kind of the same structure to the origin of the put-down teen who reads too many comic books and gets powers and makes a costume for himself. But yeah, an enjoyable book. Fun.
All right, awesome. Chris, anything last to say on what we said there?
No, not really. I just appreciated that it was just a simple story, made me laugh. Made me smile. I love the stupid origin. I mean, that was ridiculous.
All right, cool, man. You know what? We have another interview here we're kind of be saving. I'm actually throwing this one out at the beginning because this is with a very successful creator, artist, with Terry Nord, who's probably best known for working on Daredevil and more recently, and probably even best known for his fantastic work that he did with Kurt Busiek. On, and I hope I said that right, Brett, Name Police?
Busiek.
Excellent.
Busiek. Yes.
There you go. With, on Conan, over at Dark Horse. He just did awesome, awesome stuff, and it was tremendous stuff by Busiek on his end as well, writing it. So we had an opportunity, to talk to him here, and, Kerry, he was a good guy. We talked to him about digital books and kind of his perspective as an artist. We talked to him a bit about, a kind of communication between himself and editors and writers and what that's like. We talked to him about those type of things, and hopefully it came through in the recording properly because we were having those issues. But he was a terrific guy, very smart guy. And he was, even as is often the case, once we get off the air and we continue talking to him because you just can't walk away, you talk in comics and you love it, some of that stuff is actually even better than the stuff on there. And his perspective on some of the 52 stuff and kind of from a perspective, He really was somebody who wished they hadn't gone and done what they did. Was kind of the feeling I got without him actually saying it. So I don't want to put words in his mouth, but kind of got the feeling that he is one of those people who enjoyed the legacy of characters and has an old school love for it. But in some ways, we also interviewed Scott Kowalczyk, who did work for a great book called Intrepids, and hey, we'll drop his interview in an upcoming episode. And also he has a great Ready, Set, Fight? Is that the name of the book he has coming out from Oni Press? Keith, does that sound familiar?
Correct, yeah, from Oni. And Intrepids is going to be in trade paperback in February, so we want to have his interview on before we get to that.
Oh, well, it'll
be sure everyone pre-orders it.
He was great. Kerry came across to me as a guy who's great at drawing, but if he was doing, it's not just comic books. He's great at drawing, and comic books is where he's drawing. He loves to draw. But it's not so much that he loves comic books, it's that he loves to draw, and he loved to, if he was doing another business where he got to draw still, he'd be happy because it was the drawing that he loved. Whereas Scott, to me personally, came across as somebody who loves the art form of comic books and wants to only draw that and would not be happy doing anything else. That's personally the way it felt to me. I don't know if you felt the same way, Keith.
Absolutely, yeah. Carrier's just a really warm guy and great to talk to. Scott is a teacher in Calgary and such love for comics as an art form. We talked about we were going through the stack of comics that he had picked up at the show, which I always love seeing when
it was old school.
A comic creator is, it was all, it was very much, Steranko, Nick Fury and that kind of era of Marvel comics and DC comics, very like late 60s comics, most of what was in a stack.
It's great stuff. So anyways, we really appreciate it, Carrie. I think people will find this interesting and hopefully the recording comes across great. But thank you very much. And look out, he had a mystery project he felt he couldn't tell us about that I can't wait to find out what it is. He's, kind of, what do you have coming up? I don't think I'm allowed to tell you that. But we'll find out in the near future, I'm sure.
How often do you draw a page and go, that's just not right, throw it out, and do you work on perfecting it, or is it, once you have it, you know it, you see it in your mind, you're able to translate it well onto page, or?
Sometimes it's a struggle, but yeah, I've rarely ever thrown a page out, just because you can't afford the time, like sometimes you just suck it up and, well, that's the page, that's how it's going to look.
What about how long do you spend on a page on average?
Depends on the project. Like with Conan, it was, probably like ideally it would have been a page a day sort of thing, or 5 pages a week.
Yeah.
But it always, I'm a little bit slower. It'd be like a page or like almost a page a day, So it'd be like 3/4 of a page, and then it would carry over the next day. And so yeah, it's hard to say though. It all depends on what's on the page too.
Yeah.
But, the longer you have debt, like the book I'm going to be starting shortly will be 3 pages a week, so that gives me more time.
What's the book that you're starting soon?
I don't think I can say it yet.
You can't say it?
Yeah.
Well, that's too bad.
Yeah.
We were looking for an exclusive scoop, and you can still reach us almost everywhere to give it to us if you'd like.
Yeah. Keep that in mind. When I know, I'll find out.
Well, thank you very much. One last question. I don't want to take too much of your time, but it's cool. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying it. I don't know if you are, but
definitely.
When you are looking at your artwork, are you still influenced by new artists that you see very much, or do you think that your style and that you've been at it for a while is refined and you're comfortable with what you're doing? Are you always trying to add in something from other people still?
I think, I don't buy nearly as many comics as I used to, and my influences on my own personal art has been more from, classical paintings and stuff in the last little while, as opposed to comic book art. So I'm expanding that way, but not necessarily from comics as much anymore. But I think basically it's like whenever I see something that catches my eye, there's a little part of my brain that stores that away.
Yeah.
And, it might come out at some point, in as an amalgamation of everything else, so it just sort of blends in.
Well, usually when I see modern artists, the only time I usually have an issue isn't actually so much with the art style or the quality, it's the pacing of the book and how well it flows for the reader. And I figure that's probably about 50% artist and 50% writer. Is that correct? About there's some of it each there.
The writers have really taken, when I started, Marvel still had this sort of plot style, so I'd just get a page, I could break it down however I wanted. So it really gave you a chance to work on your storytelling.
Yeah.
And nowadays writers really control the pace a lot more. So, and then it's up to the artist to, round it out, I guess, and make it flow nicely. So I don't know, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, perfect. So, but it is something you were probably you had to be more conscious of in that era than you right now, where you go, this is what they want. Do you feel that? Does that kind of suck? A little bit of freedom loss?
I don't mind it because it saves me the effort of having to work it out, and certainly it just saves me a step. So I don't mind it. And plus, you can, most writers, I think, you know, are pretty good at it anyway, like, yeah. that I've worked with anyway. I've really had too many problems with writers that don't know what they're doing.
Who's your favorite writers to work with? Go ahead.
I like
I'm not saying the other ones weren't good. I'm just saying, who are your
favorites? I learned a lot from Kurt Busiek.
Yeah.
This, the guy I'm working with now, Simon Spurrier, is turning one of the greatest scripts I've seen. Just really enjoyable script. I really loved it. So, who else? Well, Warren Ellis was a treat. He was, you could tell why he's paid a buck. Yeah. Just his script was like, he made it so easy, you know, like, so, yeah, those are the three that come to mind off the top of my head.
How much communication happens after you get the script with them?
Not a lot. Because in all these cases, I mean, Kurt, I think, was the only one where it was an ongoing thing. Like, everything else was pretty much done before I even touched it, you know. So I think I had, like, a brief communication with Warren Ellis and a brief communication with Simon Spurrier. And Kurt, since it was, like, an ongoing thing, we talked once in a while. But I was more always happy to lead the writing for the writers.
Yeah.
Never been much of a writer myself, so...
Excellent. One more question turned into several more, but
yeah,
thank you very, very much. Keith here once got taken to task by Busiek on Twitter for stupid. If you care to punch him on Kurt's behalf, we don't mind.
We'll leave that up to you guys, I think. But yeah.
Well, we already did.
Okay.
He gets beat regularly.
Good stuff. Yeah.
He is our Twittering fool.
Good man, though. Shaking up the status quo. I like it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it very much.
Take care.
Thank you.
Take care.
Let's move on to our final subject of the week. And we have decided, because we've talked about Eisner and how important he is, to do a fanboy film review of The Spirit. Basically, what we're trying to look at here is not just the quality of the film, but how good a job the film did in paying tribute to the character and its origins from a perspective of comic book readers. So, who would like to open up talking about The Spirit?
I mean, to preface this whole idea is that I'll start out by just flat out saying that I hated the movie. Like,
so, what did you really think?
Yeah, I thought it was one of the worst movies that I've ever wound up seeing.
What's the last time you watched it?
In my life. It was probably about 6 months ago.
Okay. And how many times have you seen it?
I've seen it once.
Okay.
It's one of the movies that I actually purchased on Blu-ray, and I typically don't like to get rid of, or don't get rid of Blu-rays or that kind of thing, because it's the highest level that you can get right now. And that one I easily got rid of. But that's really not why we're here. The reason is that, you know, like when I was reading The Spirit.
You easily got rid of it? Not like that thing I caught from Keith's mom? Boom. See what I did there? Boom.
You can't take shots for having seen The Spirit.
You thought I was going to go to the episode without getting one in, though. Brett, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just think that that one of the things that Frank Miller was trying to do is he was trying to do too much. I felt like he was trying to go with what he knows, which is that style of green screen filmmaking. And I thought that he was trying to put all of the elements of The Spirit in, instead of just telling a good spirit kind of origin into another good story. He was trying to throw in, like, the romantic elements. He was trying to throw in the film noir elements. He was trying to throw in the superhero type elements. He was just trying to throw in, like, everything that Will Eisner kind of put in over, you know, like, decades worth of work. Frank Miller was trying to throw into a 2-hour movie.
You know, I have so much to say on what you just said. I'm gonna wait my turn, but. Oh yeah, go on.
I mean, to me, that was one of my bigger problems. I mean, I appreciate that Frank Miller tried it, but also as a first time full director, I felt like he got walked over by Samuel L. Jackson, who was awful in this movie and basically, from what I understand, like kind of took advantage and really, like, designed things that Will Eisner had never designed about the Octopus character and really went way too far.
I'm not sure he did that without Miller's input, but anyways, Keith, you're...
Well, That's what I had read.
Yeah, I read the opposite, that they created it together, but okay. So who knows? I guess we'll have to get Frank Miller or Samuel Jackson on the show and ask him. What do you say?
Seems fair.
Chris, get on that.
All right.
You got a note?
I'll get right on that.
Got a note?
Yeah. I got Sam on a speed dial, so.
And
so
why didn't you at least do that as your imitation?
Well, and with a few more books like Holy Terror, Frank Miller could very well be ready to come on our show.
A few more books like Holy Terror, and we won't have him on our show. All right, Pilgrim, what do you got to say there, Keith?
Well, I did find myself checking the dictionary to find out if the word sucktastic existed. What a... Now, I will say this is, because Paul asked this question earlier, this was my second attempt to view the film just yesterday. My first attempt, I made it 15 minutes before my wife looked at me and said, I don't want to watch any more of this movie. And then later that day, I said, okay, well, I'll watch it on my own then. And I made it about 5 more minutes until I hit the brick wall. It is Sam Jackson's awful, awful performance in this film. And I couldn't take any more. So that was about a year ago. It was last night because I was doing research for the show. I did watch it and only fast-forwarded through 2 or 3 Sam Jackson parts. So I have seen the ending of the film. the incredibly weird Sam Jackson as a Nazi section. Very strange. Terrible performances by pretty much everyone. I think instead of for the co-director of Sin City, this should have been advertised as from the writer of RoboCop 3.
That is the line of the podcast.
I had a great moment on Twitter yesterday where I wrote that I was watching The Spirit because I needed to do research for the show, and someone said that they felt really bad for me. And I said, well, I'm gonna make the rest of my co-hosts read Holy Terror, though, so we'll even out. And they responded, why do you all hate each other so much?
Well, we've met each other.
Yeah, we try to take the hits so that other people don't have to.
What we sacrifice for our listeners.
As far as adapting, I think it's a big failure as far as adapting, because really, if you put Spirit and Sin City side by side, there's really no comparison between the two. There's not a whole lot of similarities. And yet, if you put the Sin City film and the Spirit film side by side, they would look like they were from the same, had the same mind. So really what we're getting is, if Frank Miller had made The Spirit, this is what it would look like. But he didn't. And I think it's overwhelmed by that, by what he wanted to make it look like Sin City, as opposed to, you know, the more cartoonishness of The Spirit.
All right,
I'm going to take off here.
Okay,
now.
I know you are, but I just have a couple quick questions, and I'm going to ask you this as well for what you have to say. Brett, how much Spirit have you read, or how recently have you read any?
I've read a fair bit over the last week.
Okay, and Keith, how about you?
I'd say less, but I definitely flipped through some stuff yesterday and today just to get a feel for it, remind myself of it, because I would have read a lot about 20 years ago.
Okay. All right, Chris, when you, I know you're going to go off, but if you wouldn't mind including how much Spirit and how recently you've watched the movie and such, how many times, blah, 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 please go ahead.
I've seen the movie probably 6 times now. Most recently today, I watched the movie and the commentary track by Frank Miller. The first time I saw this movie was in the theater.
Yeah,
and
you and I watched it when, like, first week it came out together in the theater.
Yes.
You actually came into town, made the trip so we could see it together. The 3.5-hour trip.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, 8 hours, but okay.
All right. It's 3.5 hours for me.
You're obviously a good date, Mo.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I put out after, too. Anyways, Chris, go on.
I saw it. I loved it. I got the DVD. I watched it. I loved it. In preparation for this podcast, I popped it in the DVD player and watched it. And I was seriously trying to come up with arguments to argue this is a good movie. I got nothing.
Well, how much Spirit have you read, or how recently?
I haven't read the Spirit recently. I finished rereading Contract with God about 3 weeks ago. I haven't read any Spirit in probably 5 years.
Yes.
So I'm not as familiar. I have read a lot of it, but
I just love Chris's reviews. I love this is great. I've got nothing good to say about it. And last week when recommending when we were doing the four for a dollar, and he said, "Now this book, I'd say don't get into it." I love these honest, I liked it but no one else will reviews.
And that's why we have Chris on the show.
No, but to get back to my review of The Spirit, it's not a good movie. I think it has some brilliant moments in it. I think individual scenes are very watchable, but it doesn't hold together as a movie. And I think one of the main problems is exactly what we're talking about, is the source material and the style of the director. They clash. They clash hard. You've got the innocence of The Spirit, the sheer fun of The Spirit, and then you've got this hard-boiled noir style. Just, and they come crashing together and make this violent mess, which makes crazy shit that I love. But really, it's a dog's breakfast.
Yeah. Okay. So what you're saying?
And I would really love to tell you guys to go sit on it and to quote Potsy, and I'm right, you're wrong.
Potsy?
But it's not a good movie.
Is that Potsy who said that? Sit on it and spin, or?
I'm sure all of them said sit on it at some point.
Or was that Ralph Mouth?
It was, I think, they all would have said sit on it.
All I can tell to you is, hey. So what you're saying there, Chris, is, if I'm getting your review properly, the first five times you watch The Spirit, it's good shit, but the sixth time is the law of diminishing returns.
I still enjoyed watching it the sixth time. I just, when I was exercising my critic muscle and actually looking at it as a film, which I'd never done. I've always just popped it in the DVD player and watched it in the background and had a great old time with it, but I never thought about anything that was happening in it.
Okay, well, I'm going to say this.
But once I actually paid attention to the movie, it kind of, like, it wasn't a well-made film.
Brett, do you know how many jokes I can come up with the idea that Chris has a critic muscle? I mean...
Oh, I'm sure it's a lot.
Most of them will turn this into an X-rated podcast, and I'm trying not to do that, though it's so easy.
I think we all had moments of Scarlett Johansson that we enjoyed. That's where you're going here.
I'm going to say, okay. So you got two guys who absolutely, absolutely hate this thing, right? And then you got me, who is kind of in the middle. I think this is such a visually beautiful, arresting film. I think it's so quirky. I think it's very funny. I think it's very unique and very brave in many ways. I think it's exactly the vision the director had personally. I think he managed to get both visually and from his actors exactly what he wanted out of them. I think it's exactly the film Frank Miller wanted to make. I don't dislike this movie. I find this movie very watchable. I wouldn't go out of my way to watch it, but I enjoy it, and then I'll move on and forget about it. I don't hate it and I don't love it. For me, let's put it this way: it's not a burn it, it's not a bag it, it's a buy in our review that we use for 52s. It's just kind of a middle of the road 5 out of 10 thing. But it's like maybe 5% The Spirit, about 20% The Batman, especially with maybe more if you include the musical theme. About 20 to 30% Sin City. And maybe another character or storyline that Frank Miller has that we don't know about mixed in. It's a mishmash of a lot of things. Not The Spirit not really being any of them. You look at the changes they made as far as adapting this. The Octopus is a character who is a master of disguise who you can only know in the books. by the fact that he has a very distinctive gloves. You can look at the fact that the spirit in this has a healing power like Wolverine. In the comic books, he has no superpowers at all. He's an ordinary man, no superpowers whatsoever. His relationship with the police commissioner in this is that noir, and you know he's always talking first person. It's a contentious relationship, whereas they're the best of friends, the best buddies. They have a great relationship in the book. So there's just so many changes that he made. I think Keith said that this is Frank Miller had written the spirit, this is what it would have been. And that's what it is. And that's where, to me, my failure with the film is. It's not the actual quality of the film. I don't mind that. I laugh at a lot of this stuff. Samuel Jackson, I thought this is what they were going for. And I'm like, I know it's over the top. It's trying to be. It's not trying to be anything it isn't. I know what it is, and I can accept it and enjoy it. But it's certainly not the spirit. And it utterly fails. Chris, do you have anything to say on that?
No, I actually think a lot of the changes they made were necessary to...
Really? One? Give me one.
Well, you mentioned the relationship with... No, the superpower, actually. Sure. He died a lot in the spirit.
No, he didn't.
He died in single issues. Yes, he did. And then he was back next to you completely fine. Nope. They just didn't say he became... Yeah, he did. Nope.
No, he didn't, Chris. Chris, he did not. He did not have powers like that. He was thought to have died, and that's his origin. As a police officer who was a good man, who was a very good police officer, one of the best police officers on the force, was thought to have died and came back several years later under the spirit guise where he was completely unknown. And was not even referenced as Denny Colt anymore in Will Eisner's spirit. Was referenced was referenced generally as the spirit. He wasn't called for many, many years again, Denny Colt. He did not have powers, and he was not killed. There was times when they thought he was killed, and that was the thing. They thought he was killed, but he escaped death. But he wouldn't escape death with suffering, with getting like shot 40 times and standing up. He just happened to escape death from what seemed to be a disaster situation. Brett, you have something to say.
I've read multiple versions of his origin story, so
okay, well, I'm talking
that
about
could be where I'm going wrong with that.
The earliest version of his origin story, actually, he comes back within a few hours because the Dr. Cobra puts him into it, like it winds up putting him into a state of suspended animation. And he gets buried, and he comes back out from the grave. So it's not like weeks or anything like that. But I still don't know anything about a healing factor in any of the books that I've read.
Keith, do you have something you want to say there? You look like you're looking it up on the internet.
I was trying, but I'm not finding anything. So.
Yeah.
I don't know the character enough to.
And you're going to say that they needed to make that change with the police commissioner? Why, Chris?
Just to flesh it out to a full-length movie.
Bullshit. I'll tell you why. Because I can get that in every other movie. I can get that in every other movie. Give me one where the people actually get along. And why can't you have that and build that team? If it works for the book, why can't it work for the movie? Why does that have to flesh out a movie? Look, one thing this movie did not do was flesh out an entire plot and storyline. So I don't see how you can say that adding that in there did it. How about give me something new and actually having the police
commissioner? No, I'm just saying
if I wanted that, I'd get the version of Jim Gordon they get with the Batman, which has this sort of grudging, much of the same relationship as this, where it's this grudging acceptance, but instead of actually getting along.
It would have been a much more serious movie, and then we wouldn't have the camp, which is
how can that
true?
Be more serious that the people get along, that they're friends? That they support each other. How is that serious? That's not more serious. I don't know. How is that more serious than two people arguing with each other? And people saying things like you're going to go off an edge. Don't fall. It's a long fall.
I did feel a warmth between the characters in the movie. There was a warmth there. They did bitch at each other.
But that's the point. But why did that have to be there? I mean, sure, there's a grudging respect, as I say, a grudging acceptance. But that's not necessarily the same thing as it's not unique because they changed the idea that they actually get along in this day and age is actually a unique relationship. Again, it's not the spirit. It doesn't, I just disagree with you on this.
Okay, I didn't think that it was as an important element to the comic as you obviously do.
Keith is holding up a stuffed, what is that, a stuffed Batman or something for us, Toy? Excellent, excellent. In other words, wrap it up, boys. And now, that's who is that? Starfire, awesome. I thought it was too possible for a second there, so it shows you what I know. But
you know,
it's
not that it's so much important. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it is important because that book is about the relationships, large degree, but, and everything should be character driven. But even more than that, Chris, I think that it is, it's just one more thing that has changed that made it not the spirit and made it something else.
You know, the more that you guys talk about it, the more that I hate the movie.
And you know what? Like I said, I kind of enjoyed the movie, but it did give us the dialogue of the spirit saying, I'm going to kill you all kinds of dead. I mean, really? Really?
Oh, activate.
You can almost see Ash saying that.
Well, this did have some similarities.
I think Bruce Campbell is the spirit.
I would have ruled.
Totally.
I don't think he was bad. I had no problem with the only actor I thought was really poor in this was Scarlett Johansson. I thought she's just completely, but you know, whatever. All right. Final thoughts on the evening in general. WTC, We Talk Comics, episode 14, plugs everything like that. Indecent proposal? Whatever the hell it is. Brett.
You know, I've been left dead inside now after talking about the spirit. So I'm just going to say it's Brett at WeTalkPodcast.com, Brett _ WeTalk on Twitter. Yeah.
Awesome. Keith.
Well, I am Cub Reporter K on Twitter, and I think I just want to raise a lighter to the canceled Marvel comics of the past 2 weeks. It is a bloodbath at Marvel, and feel sorry for the creators that worked on those books. So far the count is Black Panther, Ghost Rider, Punisher Max, which is supposedly ending on its own, All Winners Squad, which will be unfinished as a miniseries, Alpha Flight, which is being switched back to a miniseries from a regular series,
Dakin, Dark Wolverine. That never happens.
Flight will finish its original 8, but has not been extended. The Dark Wolverine book is canceled, and two miniseries, Victor Von Doom and Destroyers, are canceled prior to any issues being published.
Really?
So it's been a bit of a harsh week, about 2 weeks for
Marvel. It's actually kind of looking forward books. To the Victor Von Doom. It's interesting. All right, and you know what? I'm gonna sign out, since I kind of ran over Chris there. Which I don't apologize for, but nevertheless, I'll give him a chance to sign off this week. But I'm Mo _ We Talk on Twitter, and I'm Mo at WeTalkPodcast.com. And we want your feedback. We want your ideas. We want you to visit our We Talk Podcast website, as well as visit us on Podomatic and everything else. And you know what? I'm sure some of our discussion, I'm sure somebody out there has an opinion that you can add in. Chris, please, your sign out. I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to tell the terrible joke that I think is hilarious about Viagra that Brett would only cut out anyways because he sucks.
Okay. I'm Chris at WeTalkPodcast.com. And to sign off, the spirit actually watchable. Don't listen to these guys. They're wrong.
Speaking of things I'm going to cut out.
They're always wrong. Listen to me, not them.
Good night, folks.